Welcome to the Daily Wrap Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
March 19th, 2019. Thank you for joining me yet again. I only have a few topics that I'm going to cover today, but I'm going to get into a couple of them pretty well. Now, many of you will be happy to see that it seems the U.S.-Venezuela narrative is officially beginning to crumble, and it's been crumbling for some time, but you'll see why I say officially, as we now have even mainstream media journalists reporting from in Venezuela, and what they report will likely surprise you, and unsurprisingly, the U.S. military is now contradicting the claim of 1,000 troops being left in Syria. I'll show you why it's likely still true, but first, something most of us will likely not be surprised by, and that is, of course, drills taking place at the same time as mass-covered violent events, and of course, more censorship involved in the story I'm sure you know that I'm referring to. For the first story of the day, coming from Activist Post, again, not very surprising to those that have been paying attention, entitled, New Zealand Police, quote, happened to be in a training session when mosque shooting began. Now, again, if you've been watching this channel or even just independent media for some time, you will know well by now that this is not a random occurrence. That in almost every single, if not every single major, and not just event, but majorly covered event, the events that the mainstream media chooses to cover in such a grandiose way, every single one of them, we've shown, have had drills, if not on the same moment that it happened, within a very close proximity to when it took place. And many of you may shrug this off as being, oh, just a casual coincidence, things like this happen. Well, let's get into this and you'll understand why this is not so much of a casual. It's possible. Anything's possible. But again, we always need to be asking ourselves the question, is it also possible that this could have been some kind of an orchestrated event or a used event? Knowing that it happened, or rather using somebody and coaxing them into it, such as how the FBI has been proven to have done countless times. So think about that. Now, again, this in regard to the New Zealand shooting specifically, it took officers, police officers, 36 minutes to catch the attacker who murdered 50 people in two Christchurch mosques last week. Now, dramatic footage shows that just two officers, only one of whom actually had a gun, apprehended the suspect after this attack. Now, we are now learning that this response time would have actually been much longer, but police just so happened to be conducting a drill nearby, practicing for the exact kind of an attack. Now, in what can be described as an extremely strange coincidence, Chris Cahill, a detective inspector who is president of a local labor union for police officers, explained that officers were involved in a drill near the city center when the shooting broke out at the same moment. Now, according to the New York Times, the police said a special armed tactical unit arrived at Al Noor Mosque 4 minutes after the first officers, or 10 minutes after the initial emergency call. Mr. Cahill said it normally would have taken longer, with team members summoned to a police station to suit up. On Friday, though, they happened to be in a training session in the city center and wearing their gear and, of course, armed. Now, police in New Zealand don't typically carry firearms, much less dress in tactical gear. So officers holding a drill with all their tactical equipment and weapons at the ready was certainly a helpful coincidence. But I think those of you that have been paying attention are well aware that there really is no such thing as coincidence, especially when we're talking about these kind of events. Now, for those who may be unaware, the significance of a drill in relation to these such events is very important due to the fact that most terror attacks in recent history have coincided with drills very similar, if not exactly, to the actual terrorism that is unfolding at that very moment. Now, just think about, I mean, mathematically speaking, that's almost it's impossible, in my opinion. It is a mathematical impossibility for there to always be an exact drill for the exact same thing happening at every single event that the mainstream media chooses to cover. That is just simple. That is just simple to really break down as an average person to recognize that that is absolutely astronomical. But it happens, and it has happened. Now, in November of 2015, during the tragic attacks on Paris, it was later reported that Paris area emergency personnel and ambulance crews were taking part in a simulated emergency exercise on the very same day. The exact nature of the drill was a simulated mass shooting attack, according to the doctor in the emergency room, the emergency room chief at the hospital in Paris, as well during the 9/11 attacks on the United States. North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, was in the midst of a training exercise called Vigilant Guardian, you'd think I would get that word, which coincidentally simulated planes being hijacked by terrorists. Now, here's a quick video compilation I put together for you from James Corbett's video of 9/11 war drills, which breaks a little bit better information down about this in general.
As these drills move from abstract models to real-life exercises, the line between reality and simulation can become blurry. What does it mean, then, when a simulation of an emergency takes place at the exact same place and time as the real emergency is happening in real life? In the hours after the July 7th, 2005 bombings in London, Peter Power gave a series of interviews to various outlets confirming that he had been running an exercise at the exact time of the attack. That exercise envisioned bombs going off at Liverpool Street, King's Cross, and Russell Square at exactly the same time as real bombs were going off at those very locations.
At 9:30 this morning, we were actually running an exercise for over a company of 1,000 people in London based on simultaneous bombs going off precisely at the railway stations that happened this morning. So I still have the hairs on the back of my neck standing upright.
And to get this quite straight, you were running an exercise to see how you would cope with this, and it happened while you were running the exercise.
Precisely.
Just as there are various kinds of drills, war games, and exercises, so too are there different ways that such simulations could be used to help facilitate an actual event. A drill could be used to distract security services and hinder responses, for example, thus helping an attack to succeed. Or the exercise could act as an alibi in case the plot is discovered before it can take place. Or, in an even more chilling scenario, a war game or training event could be used to recruit patsies who, believing they're only taking part in an exercise, unwittingly move people or equipment into place for a real attack. But as outlandish as this idea seems to those not immersed in military history or strategy, the idea of a war game going live is not limited to the world of fiction. In fact, it is a real and openly acknowledged secret among military planners that such exercises can be used as an operational cover for a real attack. But what about 9/11? Were there any exercises, simulations, or drills that had a bearing on what was happening on that fateful day?
I don't think anybody could have predicted that these people would take an airplane and slam it into the World Trade Center, take another one and slam it into the Pentagon, that they would try to use an airplane as a missile, a hijacked airplane as a missile.
Not only had government officials envisioned flying airplanes into buildings or using an airplane as a missile, but multiple agencies trained for just such an event prior to 9/11. In fact, as General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2001 to 2005, went on to tell the 9/11 Commission, this precise scenario of a hijacked jet being flown into a high-value target was drilled by NORAD not once or twice, but five separate times in the run-up to September 11th. But as remarkable as all of these drills and exercises are, more remarkable still are the similarities between the events of 9/11 and the war games that we now know were taking place that very morning. The exercise simulates a bioterrorist attack on New York, and on the morning of September 11th, equipment is already in place at Pier 92, just 4 miles north-northwest of the Twin Towers, to treat the victims of this pretend attack.
Now, of course, I've included that full video, which is about an hour long, for you to watch yourself, and I highly recommend you do, as he goes on to get into much more, and specifically the drills that took place the very moment, the very day of 9/11. Now, just think about the astronomical possibility, the fact that something could, like, that not just on one major event like this that literally shaped U.S. foreign policy, intentionally, that's the point, but every single one since then we can point to. All of the main shootings and all of the main attacks and terrorist actions that have happened domestically, you can every single time point to a drill. And of course, the corresponding information that it literally is the same location, the same type of attack. You just simply can't, you cannot ignore that that is exactly the mathematical impossibility of that being the case every single time. Now, the prevalence of terror drills, as the author puts it, which mirror the actual terrorist attacks being run in such close proximity to the actual events taking place, begs the question of whether these drills mirroring actual events are just a coincidence or are perhaps an indication of something much, much more sinister. Either way, this terrorist attacker who murdered innocent people will have his plans of stoking hatred and divide come to fruition as the media and the government play right into the plan. And maybe that's the point. Maybe that is exactly because that is the plan. And we have to consider this with the information we have of our own, our very own history. Now, on this very same topic, knowing that this gives us a very logical reason to question whether or not this event at the very least is being used, and rather whether or not the person that we're talking about here was manipulated by intelligence agencies or some other further more sinister manipulation, we should be able to ask these questions based on this obvious and relevant idea of the drills corresponding with the attack. But in regard to the censorship surrounding it all, and maybe this is exactly why, as many people point out, this the next article coming from Zero Hedge, entitled, "After blocking Zero Hedge and others," which has happened now, "New Zealand telcos demand big tech censorship surge to, of course, protect consumers, because it's all about your safety, shielding your delicate eyes from any negative things that may happen in your world around you." This is the important point. They always shield and they guise all of this. It's always under a guise of protecting you from things they don't want you to see. But of course, that net also happens to catch everything else that they just also don't want you to see, you know, such as the truth about so many other events happening around it. Now, in the wake of last week's terror attacks at two New Zealand mosques, which left 50 dead, several websites, which either reported on the incident, hosted footage of the attacks, or have simply allowed people to engage in, you know, uncensored discussion, such as Dissenter or Zero Hedge, have been partially or completely blocked in both New Zealand and Australia for the sake of protecting consumers. This is according to the CEO of three New Zealand telecom companies. Now, in the immediate aftermath of the shooting, which was broadcast over Facebook Live, Facebook deleted, as I've recently pointed out, 1.5 million videos of the attack, of which 1.2 million, the vast majority of which, were blocked literally at the time of upload. This is the point I made the other day about controlling your information flow real time. And this is maybe, at least how it's being used, what this is all about. To control what I'm giving you real time on live streaming, where they can either shut down the stream or actually filter out information in real time. Trust me, again, this is coming and this is being used to do that. The question you should be asking is whether or not this was created to do that, which is a logical question. And if you're, you know, offended by the idea that we would suggest that they would let people die to achieve a political goal, again, I think you're not being well enough informed of what our very own history in this country has carried out, much, much worse than what we're looking at here today. Certainly possible. Now, a video of the attacks is still freely available, of course, to anyone who wishes to download it from BitTorrent. Find it. You can easily find it yourself if you truly know where to look today. Now, Twitter, which is your right, if you truly wish to see this, which I, again, have argued why it's probably better that we don't, but you should have that right, and you should be able to if you choose to. Now, Twitter has also been aggressively censoring content related specifically to the Christchurch shooting. Perhaps more egregiously, forcing journalist Nick Monroe, who we pointed out it was under every 5 minutes he was getting another tweet, another page censored and deleted while this was happening. But forcing Nick Monroe to delete a large amount of tweets as he covered the incident in real time. Just one of which had links to footage of the shooting. Just one. But yet deleting countless amounts of his tweets. Document hosting website Scribd, meanwhile, has been deleting copies of the manifesto. But this gets even more interesting, especially in regard to Monroe's tweet here, talking about the discrepancy and the stealth, as he puts it, deletion of something that I pointed out during the very first day of this attack. In addition to documenting the incident, of course, Monroe has been noting the mass censorship surrounding this, the shootings, which we've all been able to see, but as well as things such as specifically what we're talking about here, the New Zealand Herald, and as he called it, stealth editing a March 15 article to remove mention of, quote, a well-known Muslim local who chased the shooters off, or the shooter off, and fired two shots at them as they sped off. Now, I believe the actual original quote was shooters, plural. But this is something we talked about the day, while it was happening, the same day, that they talked about a well-armed, an individual local who scared them off with a legal gun. And of course, meanwhile, they're still cracking down on restricting gun rights, which is ridiculous. It's ludicrous when you understand that this man saved people's lives at the second mosque. 41 people died in the first mosque, and the only reason less did at the other is because this man scared him away. Now, here's the actual archive. You can see it. People actually questioned this when I was covering this, that, no, that's not what the article said. Well, here's why. Because they're literally rewriting history in real time. I can't believe that people still can't come to grips with the fact that this happens, that media and government are actively trying to cultivate your perception by action, but even rewriting articles without any kind of asterisk. No, hey, we changed this article. No update, no retraction, but just a simple delete and edit without telling you, which is an egregious violation of journalistic integrity. But they do it anyway because they're trying to manipulate you. But this is important to see, that they actually censored this out in real time. Now, that said, Twitter and Facebook suppression hasn't gone far enough, according to New Zealand telecom CEOs, who have penned an open letter to Facebook, Twitter, and Google, suggesting that they follow European protocols for hyper-vigilant policing of content for the sake of course, protecting consumers. And guess what? Zero Hedge is banned again. Funny how that works. Zero Hedge has been banned in New Zealand and Australia, despite the fact that they've never hosted video footage of the Christchurch attack. They were not contacted prior to the censorship, of course. Instead, they've received a steady flow of people noting that the site is basically unavailable in these two countries. Unless, of course, you take the simple step of using a VPN. But, you know, that's easy for people that know what they're doing. But the reality is that they're basically outright censoring an entire platform, even though a platform did not host the footage or they didn't even reach out to them. I mean, this is 1984 censorship based on an opinion. Their opinion being that this outlet is somehow attributing to the spread of this information. This is alarming. I mean, this is really, truly alarming. Yes, we can cover it under the guise of our emotional outrage. Oh, this can't let this happen. But take a step forward into the future when this is now the precedent, where they can just say, well, we agree that this is not okay. We're going to censor it. We all agree as the CEOs that talking about what's really going on in Venezuela or what's really happening in Syria, that's not okay. So we're going to censor it for your protection, of course. And now, of course, banned down under are the Chans as well and video hosting platform LiveLeak, among others. So now these social media, you know, the 8chan, 4chan discussion boards, they're just deleting anywhere where people can have a free, uncensored discussion. Love them or hate them. That's their right. And this should be alarming to all of us because this, again, whether it was created for this, is being used for this, and they're manipulating you emotionally to get this to happen. Because believe you me, this has been coming for a long time. Now, moving on to some other information in regard to Venezuela that I wanted to really cover. This one is a big one for me because, of course, we've been talking about Venezuela for a very long time, and we've been covering it intensively since this new U.S. coup effort has been failing right in front of our eyes. This is a big one because this is mainstream journalists on the ground in Venezuela that went there to do a documentary that are now openly and just in every possible way debunking the mainstream narrative of Venezuela. Now, this is for those that think that we're completely wrong about it. Oh, he's an evil dictator and everyone's starving and they're eating their own animals and all the ridiculous things that they've spread through mainstream media. If you believe this stuff, this is going to be a hard one for you to wrap your mind around because these are the very people that you would blindly trust being mainstream media. Now, this is coming from Counterpunch, the original article. I prefer the title that was used by Zero Hedge that says, quote, Guaido is the most hated man in Venezuela. On the ground in Caracas versus the media spectacle, because that's a literal quote from these mainstream journalists on the ground that Guaido is the most hated man in Venezuela. But shocking, shocking that you won't hear that from mainstream media. Again, because their job is not to inform you, it is to keep you uninformed. That is the reality of mainstream media. But again, the point, on the ground in Venezuela, by mainstream journalists doing a documentary versus the media spectacle that you've been hearing and that many people have emotionally and aggressively been forcing because they know, because they talk to somebody on Twitter that lives in Venezuela. Well, yeah, that's a solid source, I'm sure. But the reality is people there, including mainstream, are now showing us that that is all utter BS. Now, British photojournalists, Ilan Jingwa, I believe, I'm probably just mispronouncing the name, and Venezuelan journalist, filmmaker Carolina Gratroyol, it's very interesting names, great role. I apologize to both of them for mispronouncing their names. I actually tried to search for them. I couldn't find any way to pronounce them properly. But the reality is, British photojournalist, we'll say Alan, and Venezuelan journalist, filmmaker Carolina, both based in London, went to Venezuela for a month to shoot a documentary for a major global TV channel. Now, they talked with journalist Paul Cochran about the mainstream media's portrayal of Venezuela compared to their experiences on the ground. Now, as Alan said, we went in June 2018 for a month to shoot a documentary. I can't disclose what channels it will be on right now, but it should be airing soon. So we'll likely be able to see more of this coming directly from them as it airs. Now, they're asked, how did being in Venezuela compare to what you were seeing in the Western media? Now, again, I've shared you the direct clips, and all this is in there for you to see for yourself. They're direct answers. It's Carolina says, I'm a journalist. I have family in Venezuela, and I knew the reality was different from what the media is portraying. But I was surprised. The first thing we noticed was the lack of poverty. The lack of poverty. Straight from mainstream journalist's mouth. Alan wanted to film homeless and poor people on the streets. I saw three people sleeping rough just this morning in London, but in Venezuela, we can't find any. In big cities or towns. Now, how does that jive with what they've been trying to tell you? She goes on to say, we wanted to interview them, but we couldn't find them. It is because of multidisciplinary programs run by the government with social services working to get children off the streets. Sounds like something we could use in the United States or return to their families. The program has been going on for a long time, but I hadn't realized how effective it was. Things look worn down and tired. There is food. There are private restaurants, she says, and cafes open. And you could feel the economic crisis kicking in, but poverty is not as bad as what I've seen in, say, Brazil or Colombia, where there are lots of street children. Funny how the U.S. isn't wringing its hands over the groups that they're working with to try to overthrow Venezuela. Interesting how that works. This gets better. They ask the question, how have the U.S. sanctions impacted Venezuela? Well, of course, they say food is expensive, but people are buying things. The government has created a system, local communities for production and supply, known as the Spanish acronym CLAP, that feeds people. 6 million families every month via a box of food. This is coming from the journalists themselves. I mean, it just right off the bat. It's very, very, it's right in your face how directly contradicting this is to the mainstream narrative. Says people were a good size and nobody is dying from hunger or malnutrition. Outright, nobody is dying from hunger or malnutrition. From mainstream journalists on the ground in Venezuela, they ask, so the crisis we read about every day is primarily due to U.S. sanctions? They ask. And they says the sanctions have affected the country. This economic war started waging internally and also externally, blocking international loans. Interesting, that's exactly what we've been saying, that they have effectively blocked them from being able to find their way out of a hole that the U.S. created for them. Goes on to say, so what are Venezuelans eating, they ask. Again, you know, trying to dig at this, trying to pick the scab, this interviewer trying to find a way to make this look bad for Venezuela like they usually do. But they respond, the main complaint was that people couldn't eat meat like they used to. The situation is not that serious. I mean, come on, people. It's humorous to me that this, of course, for the people likely, and this is my assumption, that have been going along with the mainstream narrative this far, will just disregard these people. Even though if they came back with the opposite story, it would be heralded as truth on the ground. But mainstream journalists that come back and tell you the opposite, sort of like Alfred Isaias, the expert from the UN, did and said, no, this is the wrong thing. The sanctions are causing this. They just ignored him. But now we have mainstream journalists. The situation's not that serious on the ground. And he points out before Hugo Chavez came to power, Venezuela had 40% critical poverty. And that's, of course, when they were run by U.S. puppets, remember this, before them, out of 80% poverty. but that rate went down to 27%. Oh, terrible socialism here. Again, I shouldn't even say that because I'm not advocating for socialism, and I know people will take it that way. The reality is that's the ridiculous narrative that just because of this ideology, everything's so terrible. I think all government's bad, personally, socialism and democracy. But the reality is it's not just that. It's U.S. propaganda and their sanctions and their actions. But during the time when Chavez was ruling, went down to 27, and before the crisis, was just 6 or 7% critical poverty, which is massively bigger just over the border in Colombia. That country is in a massive critical poverty crisis. But because it's a U.S. ally, they just won't talk about it. It says everyone is receiving help from the government. Again, what a terrible dictator they are by helping all their people. It says also mango trees are everywhere, so you can pick a mango whenever you want. Funny how that works out. They go on to say the real attack on the economy is on food. When you have hyperinflation, everything goes up in price. But bills like water, electricity, public transport haven't gone up that much. This is why the distortions in the economy are not intrinsic, but caused by external factors. Otherwise, everything should have gone up, no matter what it is. What a logical, clear-minded point. If there was really a specific problem on their side, government mismanagement, managing the economy, everything would generally go up. But the point they're making is it's caused by specific external factors. And that's why water specifically and food are the problems. But everything else is generally the same because this is a targeted economic attack. Goes on to ask, what about the power cuts that have plagued the country? They respond, during blackouts, people told stories, played music, or went out and talked on the streets. It was a paradise, they say. No TVs, smartphones, but real human contact. What a stark contrast to the horrifying, nightmarish scene the mainstream media tries to sell you. Remember, these are mainstream journalists that were there, living there, conducting a documentary, meaning not just a day, but an ongoing investigation. They say people cook together. During the day, they are playing board games, dominoes, and kids are having fun. What a terrible blackout that sounds like. And he goes on to say, people with kids are possibly more stressed, especially if you live in a tower block, as you've got no electricity. And remember, this is because of U.S. actions, and says you've got no water. That is why the U.S. hit the electric grid, this mainstream journalist very clearly says, as it means no water in Caracas. Let me repeat that. That is why the U.S. hit the electricity grid. Good Lord. It says a city of 10 million people. Luckily, there are wells with clean water, which the U.S. wouldn't tell you around the city, so people queue up to get it. Hey, and everything seems fine. They ask the question, so there was a real discrepancy between the image you were given of Venezuela and the reality? Yeah, maybe this interviewee is not really paying attention to what they're saying. They respond by saying, sure, there are queues for oil, but people are not dying of starvation. Let me repeat that. People are not dying of starvation. And as I said, poverty is nowhere near what it's like in Brazil. I wouldn't say a harsh dictatorship. People were open and criticizing the government and the U.S., but also Chavez and Maduro. See, this is something they've failed to recognize and reconcile in their ridiculous narrative, is why would a dictator allow massive rallies of anti-Maduro protests to go on within his own country? Oh, what an evil dictator. Why would he allow Guaido to wander around screaming about overthrowing the government? That's not the actions of a dictator. No one's trying to claim he's the best person alive. I don't trust any government official, but they're all equally as corrupt as far as I'm concerned, but the lies they're telling are on their face ridiculous. And he's very clearly saying that people were allowed to walk around and criticize him. They said there's no dictatorship here. He says people were not feel fearful about speaking out. I think Venezuelans blame the Americans for the situation more than Maduro. I mean, think about how fearful Americans are to speak out against the government here for fear that the CIA is going to start tracking them. I mean, seems like that's little people are more free there. People still do it here, but the reality is making clear that people are speaking out openly and with no fear of reprisal. Very stark contrast to what they want you to think there. They ask, what do you make of the hullabaloo in February about U.S. and Canadian aid being blocked by Venezuela? A good question because we've covered this a lot. They say it is a Trojan horse, flat out, first thing out of his mouth. It is a Trojan horse, a good way to get the U.S. in, and why international agencies were not willing to take part in the plan. Instead, there has been a Russian and Chinese aid coming in, and as well as Turkey and about seven other countries I can think of off the top of my head, including the Red Cross, mind you. It's just funny because these people are clearly actually doing their research, and it's not even like a question about whether it's this way or that way. They're outright saying, no, that was a complete lie. The world's acknowledged that that's a politicized aid effort to overthrow the country because these people have done the research. I mean, it's just staggering to me. And here's the last one I want to cover. They say very clearly, there's not the chaos U.S. and Trump were expecting. Opposition leader and self-proclaimed President Juan Guaido is the most hated guy in Venezuela. These people are on the ground experiencing it there. And not the Eva Bartlets and the Vanessa Bealeys of the world that the mainstream circles think are absolute propagandists, even though the only people telling the truth. These are mainstream journalists that otherwise would be heralded as heroes if they had said the opposite. Really let that sink in. The most hated guy in Venezuela. He has to stay in luxury hotels in La Mercedes, I'm probably mispronouncing that, an expensive neighborhood of Caracas. They have electricity there as they were prepared, so bought generators. That is why Guaido went there and has a whole floor of luxury hotel for him and his family. While people are suffering, Guaido is trying on suits for his upcoming trip to Europe. It is a parallel world. I mean, I just really don't understand how people can still think what's happening on the ground in Venezuela, or rather what they're telling you is happening there, is the reality. We have roundly proven every single one of their claims to be verifiably false. We have independent journalists on the ground showing you regularly the lies. Now we have mainstream journalists. But just like with the BBC producer coming out about Syria, they're just going to pretend they didn't say anything. They're going to ignore it. So the average people only watching mainstream will never even hear about what this person has to say. That is how they control it. Just like we covered yesterday about the propaganda multiplier. They get told what to say. They dutifully repeat it. That's mainstream media. That's where it comes from. They trust me, they really want you to think they've got these secret inside sources that know everything that's going on. All you got to do is trust them. And that is an utter lie. I really hope this gets through to some people because this stuff is powerful. And I'm looking forward to the documentary that probably won't get aired. Now, for the final story of the day, a quick follow-up on something that I covered yesterday that I wanted to cover because it's has to do with Syria and the troops that are staying, because they've already come out, as I kind of expected, saying, no, that's not true, kind of exactly the way they did about every other step of this process. No, that's a complete lie, and then it turns out that it was right all along. This is what we're talking about. Now, this is entitled, Top U.S. General Denies Plans to Leave 1,000 Troops in Syria. This is every single step of the way. From we're leaving Syria to 200 people, to 400 people, to now 1,000 people, to every step it has been that it gets, somebody talks about it and it gets casually denied until it actually happens. So I truly think this is what's happening, as an official spoke candidly with the Wall Street Journal. But that also, it could be definitely fake. We've known that Trump, at least in my opinion, has let information get out intentionally that is not true, so to point to the media and make them look bad. That's my opinion. I think that's happened quite a bit. But now we have U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Joe Dunford issuing a statement just yesterday denying the weekend reports that the U.S. plans to leave about 1,000 troops in Syria, saying that they're factually incorrect. So what is it, 900? You know, it's the way that they present it that makes it clear that there's more to the story. Again, I truly feel that this is true, and they're just dragging their feet for a time when it gets less attention. Now, Dunford presented the current planned residual force as 200 still, interestingly, saying that this hadn't changed since February, except for the fact that the U.S. announced 200 people would stay on the 21st of February, but then on this 22nd, officially said it was 400. So even his claim right this moment that it hasn't changed has clearly already changed. So they're now, I don't even think they have their information square between themselves. 400 has been the official statement now, and he's saying it's still 200. Now, it's not clear from Dunford's statements where the incorrect aspect of the new report is coming from, which again came from Wall Street Journal. That report suggests that the 1,000 figure was not yet finalized, I guess, but was being discussed. Dunford's comments didn't include any details on what is actually being discussed, but just that nothing was finalized. Very clearly making it seem that they're just exactly the same thing they did with the 200-400 scenario. They know we're full pullout, it's still happening, and they denied it until they officially did it, and they said, okay, now it's official. We denied it until it was official. It's the same exact thing. So this is clearly, in my mind, what is about to happen. Now, this could mean that calls for more troops, doubtless coming from administration war hawks, aren't the slam dunk that the Wall Street Journal was presenting them as. That's certainly possible. But it could, on the other hand, mean that the administration is just not ready to announce the new figures publicly yet, not officially. and will just insist the media is lying until some future date when it's more convenient and no one's really paying attention to make those numbers official. And they could pretend that at that moment they didn't mean it, oh, now it's official. We only just now came to this conclusion. Now, either way, it seems certain discussions are ongoing, as the 400 figure was based on assumptions of Western European troops staying as well, and so far the U.S. has failed to convince any of those countries to do that. The point being that it's still up in the air. That number could become 2,000 by next week. And as the point still remains, the U.S., for sure now, is not leaving Syria. Now, thank you for tuning in today. I hope some of this information in particular about Venezuela really stuck with some people. I'm going to be covering a live event tomorrow, a concert in Boise called the Tree Fort Festival. Actually, I believe Media Monarchy is going to be there as well, James Evan Pilato, and I'm hoping to officially meet him. We know each other online, but I'm going to be covering this there. I have a press pass to go and discuss something with the artist for WKUP, in particular the artists that I like that I think are more about, you know, using lyrics in a way to open people's minds to the kind of stuff that I talk about. So I plan on doing a show every single day for the next 3-4 days. But just in case I miss one for whatever reason, know that it's because I'm covering this event live, the Tree Fort concert, and I'll try to post information so you can see it for yourself. But I still plan on doing a show every day. So make sure you stay tuned. Plenty more interesting information coming out. I love you all. And as always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.